This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to Keyboard Kimura, the official mixed martial arts podcast of The Province. Here are your hosts, Paul Chapman and E. Spencer Kite.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Keyboard Kimura podcast here on Province Sports Radio. I am E. Spencer Kite. We got 1 week of Paul Chapman after a couple of weeks vacation. He's not on vacation again. He's actually laid up. He had some emergency surgery. So get well soon, Chappie. But as is often the case in these situations, when I'm without a sidekick, when I'm without somebody riding shotgun, go to the man that logs a ton of hours on the road, my partner in crime, my dude, Dwayne Finley. Thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate you jumping in on short notice.
Oh, you know, man, all you gotta do is throw that bat signal up from Canada. I see it shining from the West Coast, and I'm like, all right, Canada needs me. I'm just trying to shoot up.
Well, and part of it, too, besides just our friendship and your always being ready to jump in, is you were at the Nashville show, obviously, that took place last weekend. Feel like that's a good sort of jump-off point for this week. Talk a little bit. Not a lot happened, but there were a couple of strong performances. You and I have always talked about sort of divisions and the way they break down and the way they shake out. So it felt like a good card to do a little bit of that. Talk about some of these fights that have been announced. I know you're close with Carlos Condit. He's got a big fight coming up. So figured it made sense to reach out. You're done a little vacation in Tennessee, and we'll chop this up.
Yeah, man. I was glad to get the call. It was interesting. Yeah, my journeys are endless, as it seems. But hey, I'm happy. I think that outside of the Carlos Condit thing, which we'll talk about later, I think that's my only other travel for the rest of the year. I think the Bo Sivas are going to be homebound. But yeah, Bo Sivas was in the Great Smokies and rocking and rolling. And it was just a good time, man.
So we'll do this sort of in reverse order of the card. We'll get to the main event last, because I think for me, it wasn't a huge surprise. It didn't really tell me anything I didn't know, but it still is interesting for how the division's going to play out going forward. But just looking at that card and thinking back to that card, what were some of the standout performances for you? What were the things that really jumped off the page for you as you were sitting there cage side watching these fights go down?
The three that I could think of off the top of my head was Scotty Holtzman. Looked good, man. He looked, wild. He was wild and kind of out of control at the beginning, but I mean, I think that's what you get when you get hot sauce. John Crouch is gonna get that pared down, and I think Scotty Holtzman can do some things there in the future. Amanda Nunes, wow, she I didn't think she beat Sarah McMahon, and she did it impressively. And then Derek Brunson, how about Derek Brunson, the selfie king of Instagram, coming out and throwing them things. And I know Smiling Sam wasn't too happy with it, but he was out, man. I don't know how it looked on TV, but Sam was in big, big trouble, and referee did him a favor. Mario Yamasaki, I believe.
Yeah, Sam was definitely, it was funny to see him sort of protest and say, I wasn't out. My wife was watching with me. And even Sarah looked at the replay and was like, dude did the drunk wobble. You're out when you do that, like, I can't stand up properly. So it's tough to believe your no, I'm good, when your first action of trying to stand up is that little, like, speed wobble we all do when we've had one or two or six too many and we try to get out of the booth and walk home.
Oh, yeah, and the thing was, is he was doing it all along the cage. I mean, his legs were gone. I think, in my opinion, Marco gave him more. Actually, probably let it go on just a little too long. You know what I mean? Like, Derek was lacing him, and Sam wasn't doing anything about it. So yeah, those are the fights that stood out to me. There was, you described it best. I think you hit it right on the head when you said that this card was a great kind of divisional filler card. Like, you're not filler in the traditional sense of the word, but these divisional races have to go on. These people have to go up the ranks. People have to climb. People have to fall. This card was just kind of filled with a lot of 15 to 20 range stuff, you know. And an important fight at light heavyweight. Not maybe not the sexiest fight, but it was important, you know.
Well, and one of the ones that really jumped out, and there was the automatic reaction afterwards from the Amanda Nunes fight of, oh, well, she's now instantly a contender. She could now be the next in line for Ronda Rousey, which feels a little bit like, hold on now, let's slow our roll a little bit. Not that it wasn't an impressive performance. Capitalized on Sarah McMahon sort of throwing that low kick, turning very slowly, not getting her hands up. Luke Thomas actually did a really good job breaking it down on his Monday Morning Analyst, talking about you see guys normally when they throw that kick, they get the leg up, they get the hand out, referenced Paul Felder, who did it a lot in his fight with Edson Barbosa a couple of weeks ago. McMahon did none of that and caught a right hand down the pipe and pretty much was done from there. For me, I don't necessarily go, okay, Amanda Nunes, automatic contender. Because I remember sort of the development and some of those previous fights, her loss to Alexis Davis, even her loss to Sarah Diello, she's always been sort of that person that comes out quick, has a really great start, and then if she doesn't get you early, it becomes a little dicey. So while for me it's very much an impressive performance and one that puts her on the map, I still want to see even maybe a rematch with Alexis Davis. Or a fight with, you know, Jessica Eye is now booked, but that seemed like, to me, sort of the next step for her. What were your thoughts? Do you buy into this because we need contenders and challengers for Rousey that we just sort of hotshot anybody that gets an impressive win?
Honestly, my head was in entirely the different direction, man. I watched that fight. When it ended, I was thinking about how far Sarah McMahon has fallen. but more than I thought about Amanda Nunes going up, Nunes going up. But yeah, man, if you look at that, I mean, it's hard to shake that. To think that, you know, just north of a year ago, you know, Sarah McMahon was that, you know, she was the one that was going to beat Ronda Rousey, and she has the undefeated record. And it seemed like, I wrote in the Good Bad Strange column that, you know, even though she was, you know, the machine kind of paid her in that position, she never really seemed that she wanted it. You know, I mean, even when she tried to put her game face on, you know, she kind of was like, eh, you know, like just not quite ready for prime time, at least mentally. And it's crazy to think that, you know, the Rousey fight was February of 2014, and here we are in, you know, August of 2015, and she's lost three out of her last four.
And very well could have lost the decision against Lauren Murphy as well.
Absolutely. Could have been on a straight four-fight losing skid. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's like, okay, well, and then, you know, on top of what you're talking about, you know, thin division. So it's like, okay, well, you know, they're talking about, oh, Nunes is a contender, which I'm not buying for a second. You know what I mean? Like, okay, you know, if Ronda's proven anything to us, it's like there's a huge gap between Ronda and everybody else. And that position is only solidified by Misha Tate's success.
Right.
Misha Tate beats everybody else except Ronda. So if people aren't good enough to beat Misha, who's good enough? You know, who's going to fight? Who's going to fight Ronda? Who's going to give her a chance? Who's going to give her a test? So, you know, yeah, I'd like to see, you know, the Alexis Davis thing. A rematch makes sense. Maybe, you know, Holly Holm. You know, that could be an exciting fight. So, you know, I don't know. All I'm saying is the false grace for Sarah McMahon, who's a lovely woman, and she's tough as nails. Just fighting, you know, might have just got here too late to the game, man. Circumstances may just be getting the best of her.
Well, and it's funny you mentioned that we had sort of pegged her as maybe she's the one to beat Ronda. She had even said, sort of going into that fight, I think I'm the one that's going to beat Ronda Rousey whenever it's all said and done. The thing for me with Sarah McMahon that I've sort of noticed throughout, and the first real instance of it for me was the Ronda fight, but you sort of look at a knee to the midsection like that, and that's going to take the wind out of just about anybody. But then the Misha Tate fight, she sort of just doesn't have that. It's almost to me a little bit like Brock, where that shot comes, and because the background is wrestling and she's not necessarily used to the physical punishment of actually getting punched in the face, her immediate reactions are so sharp that it presents an opportunity for her to get finished. Not that, you know, Amanda Nunes didn't clock her solid and it wouldn't have sent me spinning. But for a cage fighter, for somebody that this is your profession, you're out there saying, I'm going to be the one to beat Ronda Rousey. Every time she gets hit clean, it seems like her reaction is, get me out of here. And that's a difficult thing. I mean, not, as you said, not to take anything away from Sarah McMahon, who is a wonderful woman, who does have, you know, a tremendous pedigree on the mat in terms of wrestling. I even just look at it a little bit as, you know, this sport and to succeed at the highest level for a lot of people is just about choices. She's made the choice and the decision to stay home, be with her family, sort of commute up to New York to train with Marcelo Garcia on occasion. I talked to her before her last fight, and she talked about doing sort of training with Phil Nurse over Skype. Training with Phil Nurse is great. Doing it over Skype so that you could stay home, that's cool. But the better thing is training live with Phil Nurse. And so I wonder if it's just a situation of not making some of the choices other people make. And Amanda Nunes is sort of a perfect offset of that, because she was with MMA Masters, made the decision to go to ATT full time, and we've seen the results since.
Well, I think that with kind of staying on the Sarah McMahon thing, I also think a lot of it, you know, I wonder if, you know, we know, because we've covered this sport for a long time now, we know how it works inside and out. It's a huge commitment to do it, and I wonder with how much of her life she committed to being to wrestling. You know, to that grind to be an Olympic, you know, medalist or Olympic level wrestler. You know, I mean, there gets to be a point in your life where you're like, you know, I don't want to have to compete like that anymore. You know, she has a kid, she has a family. It's like, you know, this is, you know, and the demand in MMA is rigorous too. Like you said, she's trying to split hairs by trying to make ground where she can, and that's the thing, man. It's a tough thing to do both. I mean, it's a tough thing to cover this sport with a family, let alone fight with a family. You know, I wonder if there's just not some other things going on there and some tough decisions that she's going to have to make coming up.
I think so, and it'll be interesting to see sort of what the UFC decides to do, because as you mentioned earlier, division is pretty thin. Having a Sarah McMahon in there as sort of a little bit of that measuring stick and a little bit of that litmus test for some of these other fighters climbing the ranks is always a positive, because she does have, you know, that grappling base and that wrestling base that is a good test for, say, someone like Holly Holm or someone maybe even like Juliana Pena. I know she has a fight, but just throwing names out there. But at the same time, as we said, could be on a 4-fight losing streak, is currently 1-3 in her last 4. So there may be just a, you know, maybe Sarah McMahon makes the decision for the UFC and says, I'm done. I want to focus on my family and just being home. But it'd be interesting to see what happens with her going forward, for sure.
Yeah, I agree, man. I certainly agree. And then, like I said, I'm not trying to not give Amanda Nunes her due here. She fought an excellent fight. But, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like it was one of those fights where Sarah McMahon did what she did everything she needed to do to lose. More right. than Amanda Nunes did to dominate it, you know what I mean? So yeah, you know, like I said, not discrediting her, a great fight, but, you know, we'll see what comes next.
Yeah, it's one of those things, and you and I have talked off-air dozens of times about not putting much stock in rankings and things like that. You look at the new UFC rankings, and Amanda Nunes is number four, makes a 3-spot jump. To have her ahead of Sarah Kaufman, even though Sarah Kaufman's coming off a loss to Alexis Davis, is crazy to me. That maybe is even a fight that I would like to see. I know that Sean Shelby and Joe Silva don't normally make person coming off a win or a winning streak against person coming off a loss. But Amanda Nunes hasn't been able to clear Sarah McMahon, sort of that first big name, established name. And even Sarah McMahon hasn't necessarily beaten some of those people in the past. So give me one more fight against somebody in that top 5 and a similar performance, and I'll be fine. But for right now, I want to reserve judgment and not run her into a title fight with Ronda Rousey.
Yeah, why not do Kat Zingano?
Absolutely.
You know, Cat hasn't fought since fighting Ronda. Be a great fight for both of them. I mean, that's a win coming off a loss, but that loss, the title fight, so holds a little more sway. Give me that fight and then see what's up.
You mentioned Derek Brunson in there a little earlier as well, getting a victory over Sam Alvey. He jumps up two spots in the middleweight division. We've talked about middleweight a lot, how it's sort of, in the last couple of years, gotten deep, gotten interesting. Is Brunson a guy that you think can really make a run at this, or is he more a guy that's probably going to max out in that 6 through 12 range where he is now, but always be an entertaining, fun dude to watch? Because his one loss in the UFC came to Yoel Romero in the third round of a fight. He was ahead 2-0 on the scorecards.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. So that's like that. If you remove the Romero fight and look at the guys he's beaten, you're like, well, you know, maybe this guy's just kind of 8 through 12 space, you know, and maybe he just, you know, like you said, gives us exciting fights. Then you look at the one loss, and you're like, man, he was taking it to Yoel Romero. He was lighting Yoel up for those first two rounds, then blew his gas tank out and got put away in the third. You know, and Yoel is right now, you know, a fight away from a title shot. So, you know, I wonder the same things that kind of you posed, you know, when you posed the question. But then I think about, like, you know, Derek's a guy who is he's one of those guys who's just, he's versatile. I mean, like, he doesn't just rely on his wrestling. He comes out there and throws hands, and he's got good speed and good power. So I really think that it all depends on, to answer your question, I think it all depends on how this next year goes for him growth-wise. If Derek really buckles in and says, hey, you know what? I talked to him before this fight for UFC.com, and he said, you know, he believes in his mind he can beat any middleweight out there. And hearing him say that, I believe that he believes that. Now, it's if he's going to do the work to back that up, I think we could see something special from him. But, you know, the end of 2015, beginning of 2016 is going to tell the tale for Brunson, because he's going to draw somebody solid in his next fight. Not saying Alvey wasn't solid, but he's going to draw, you know, like a Talis Leitis or a, you know, or somebody like, you know, in the Bisping range. So he's going to draw somewhere in that 6-10 range, I think, for his next fight. And I think that's going to be like the show improved, in my opinion.
Well, and he's another guy that sort of similar to the first guy you mentioned from the show, Scott Holtzman, who I talked to on Tuesday's story up on Wednesday on Keyboard Kimura, talking about his debut win and just sort of his experiences of fight week at home. But Brunson and Hot Sauce are both guys that came to the sport a little later in life, sort of at 26, 27, as opposed to 22, 23, or even earlier, like we're seeing with some of these up-and-comers. So it's been 5 years, and it's sort of just, feels like it's just starting to come together. As you said, he's starting to have that belief in himself that you really need at this level of, I can beat anybody. I look at the division, I look at sort of some of these established names and guys that, you know, are either on the way down a little bit, like Michael Bisping. Tim Kennedy is still ranked, but I think he's more or less done. I look at a fight with your boy Gegard Mousasi and think this is what I want to see in terms of that next guy to maybe move into that top five, replace sort of the Anderson Silvas, Vitor Belforts, Lyoto Machidas, as somebody that can be in that mix maybe going forward over the next couple of years.
Oh, yeah, man. I think that'd be great if they did Mousasi Brunson. I think that'd be fantastic, you know. And then, or you know who they probably will do is Whitaker, who just beat Tavares. They could probably do Whitaker and Brunson if they wanted to kind of, you know, stave off more of that top 10, because I don't know how those guys are booked out without looking at it. But yeah, man, I think, you know, 185 has some interesting players. You know, Elias Theodoro's in that mix. As young guys, as guys coming up, so I think there's going to be some interesting action at 85 from here on out and into early next year for sure.
So one more for me before we get to the main event from UFC Nashville, talking with Dwayne Finley, who was covering the show last weekend. Is that co-main event? You were there. Press row is actually one of those cool spots to sort of score a fight from, because you're a little bit further back than the judges, obviously, but you have some of those obstructed angles like the judges do. Fight came down to a split decision. Beneil Dariush got a victory 29-28 on two cards over Michael Johnson. Most people I think every media person on social media scored the fight for Johnson. You being there cage side, did you have it the same way the rest of us did? And what are just sort of, I mean, I know it's a pretty nebulous question, but what are some things that we could do to stop this from happening, man? Because it seems like it's happening every event that there's one decision that we're like, hang on, they scored that for who?
Well, I think that, the outrage was pretty clear, but I think it really came down to that second round because, I mean, I had the fight. I felt that Johnson won the first two rounds, but I remember leaning over to Matt Erickson and saying, man, I really don't know. I mean, that first round was pretty clear because he did tag him with the knockdown of sorts. But the second round was a lot closer than people are really thinking about. I mean, Derry Goose kept sticking him with that jab over and over and over and over and over. And Darius would press the action, then back off, press the action, back off. Well, it was really tough fight to score but in reality, it should be the easiest fight to score because the fight never went to the ground.
Right.
So Darius clearly won the third round. Johnson was fading and he slowed quite a bit. But, in the second round, did some damage on Mike's left eye and he was peppering him up. But still, I think it's a tendency to watch the guy who's kind of leading the dance to be like, okay, that guy's pressing the action, kind of the, Diego Sanchez, Martin Campman style of Louisville. So, the second round, the first round I had for Johnson, second round, I did give to Johnson because he landed a couple clean right hands. And my question from Chris Rowan, how is Terry Hughes not getting pegged with those left hooks on that counter? Michael was throwing them all day, and they were just missing. Any one of those would have put Terry Hughes' life out. I mean, that's how close these punches were. I was like, okay, second round's a little iffy. Third round's clear to Terry Hughes. So I had a feeling that we were coming in for some kind of crazy business. And I was like, man, I could see at least one of these judges seeing that second, third round. I didn't think two of them would see it. So, yeah, to kind of answer your question how we stop it, I really don't have a good answer for that because I was kind of mystified in that whole thing, too, where I was like, man, this first round was clear, third round was clear, second round, Johnson felt like he had the momentum because he was coming out the first so strong. The second round, Darius held his own, and started coming on towards the end. I was like, I can kind of see this happening. But I just scored 2-1 for Michael. But it didn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we know as fans and as media and as observers of the sport, we know sort of the criteria that these fights are scored on. And everybody wants to talk about cage control and aggression and all of that stuff. And to me, having gone through John McCarthy's command course, I've got the certificate if anybody wants to see it. Managed to pass. I didn't get bounced. I did things well enough to know what I'm talking about a little bit. It felt like one of those rounds where a lot more was weighted on, as you said, Michael Johnson being the aggressor, Michael Johnson being the one in the center of the octagon, dictating sort of where the fight took place. And in going back and watching it, you're absolutely right. Darius was countering well, moving out of the way, not getting into those pocket exchanges where he would be most susceptible to what Michael Johnson does. And so as much as in the moment I had that same reaction as everybody else of this is crazy, Michael Johnson clearly won that fight, the more I go back and watch it and take it in a couple more times, I can see a little bit of where that comes from. And as weird as this may sound, it sort of makes me feel a little positive that maybe we are starting to see a little bit of growth in an understanding of it doesn't necessarily have to just be the guy that's coming forward that's winning the fight. It's not necessarily just the guy that's on top or hits the do-nothing takedown in the last 30 seconds that gets the round. That doesn't do Michael Johnson any good today. Hurts his chances in the division right now for a little bit, makes him take a step backwards. But I think we might actually be starting to move forward a little bit in the judge's understanding of effective striking and things of that nature, not necessarily just weighing, well, this is the guy that's coming forward.
absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, from watching that fight up close and personal, you know, Derek Hughes was peppering him with that jab. And then he would throw a real meaty kick in there, boom, hit it. He'd jab his way out of it. Johnson was throwing a lot of stuff that didn't connect. And throwing a lot of punches that were nowhere near landing. And then he would, you know, he'd catch Derek Hughes kind of coming, you know, kind of sitting still for a second, kind of pushing with the right hand. You know, outside of that right hand he landed in the first round, you know, Dariush was moving away from all the rest of them. So, like, they hit, but Dariush was already on his way out, so they didn't hold quite as much impact. So yeah, I mean, like I said, I got the outrage that it felt like, you know, feeling and seeing and understanding are two different things. Like, you kind of feel the momentum of a fight, and you kind of see this guy pushing the other guy kind of retreating all the time. But then when you really kind of, like you said, go back and look at a second, maybe a third viewing, you realize that how much better Dariush established his jab and how much that was, you know, frustrating the heck out of Michael Johnson in that second round. And it definitely showed in the third.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think it's kind of a weird situation where even though it felt wrong, there's some positives in there because maybe judges are starting to kind of see counter-striking for how effective it can be instead of just kind of, you know, what do you call it, like penalizing guys for moving backwards.
Right. So we'll get to the main event, light heavyweight matchup. Glover Teixeira breaks his two-fight losing streak, gets a third-round technical submission win over Ovince St. Pro, puts him to sleep in front of the home crowd, in front of his parents, watching him fight live for the first time, which has got to be a little bit weird and feel a little bad for OSP. To me, this felt like a fight that was a step up and another opportunity for OSP to maybe take that next step up in the division, get a win over an established guy. But going into it, I felt it was going to play out the way it did, not to pat myself on the back or anything like that, but it just felt like a fight where Glover Teixeira, who has underrated wrestling and strong hands, would get inside, get this fight to the canvas, and we would see it end this way. It didn't necessarily change anything in terms of the divisional picture, but I think it just further cements the tiers of the division, if that makes sense. What were your takeaways of the fight? How did you expect it to play out? And this division, what does this do for Glover going forward?
Well, how I expected to play out was similar, but my big question hovering over the fight was, would we see Glover be able to handle adversity and get into that gritty game that put him where he, you know, put him in a title shot? You know what I mean? Because so oftentimes guys fall in love with their hands, and then their power becomes that thing they do, or they use their power to rock their opponent and then dive in on submissions, and then that looks different on the record. Now, how are you going to respond when that guy doesn't go away because of your power? You're going to have to dig down, use your wrestling, fight a grueling fight to get that win. See, I wasn't sure, after watching how Glover fought Phil Davis, I wasn't sure if he still had that in him. And this fight showed that he absolutely does. I mean, it wasn't a pretty fight by any means, But you know, Glover's at his best when he has the ability to make it an ugly fight. And that's what he did. You know, OSP came out looking good early on, and then Teixeira just went to his wealth of tools, you know, dominated it on the ground and took it right back there every time he had the opportunity to do so. So, and as far as OSP going to sleep in front of his family, there was a moment there, I don't know if you caught it, but OSP almost tapped. And then he just decided to go out. He's like, hey, I think there's it's a badge of honor in MMA that you just go out on your shield, you know, don't tap, just go all the way out. And OSP brought that hand up to tap, put it back down, and the next thing you know, he was snoozing. You know, and snoozing in Music City. So, I think you're right. Does it show much, doesn't do much for the division, except maybe establish that there are... You know, there are breaks in talent levels, but for me, this fight showed me that Glover has the ability to dig in and fight that gritty, dirty fight that he's absolutely going to need if he's gonna contest for a title again. Because, you know, I'm not sure if he ever gets back up there again, but how he fought on Saturday shows me that he has tools to give anybody in the division problems.
Well, and that, for me, is going to be the interesting thing going forward, because Glover currently sitting at number three in the division. Obviously, John Jones looms as sort of the wild card. We don't know when he's coming back. Rashad Evans getting back into the cage against Ryan Bader coming up here not too far down the line. That's a fight that clearly will have some impact on that upper tier. But Glover's in a position now, and he called out, not really called out Daniel Cormier, but said, you know, DC, I told you I'm going to be coming for you and stuff like that. I think he very much is a guy that probably number three, number four, where he is now, is the highest he's going to get. I would favor Anthony Johnson, Daniel Cormier, and Alex Gustafson over him. Obviously, we saw what John Jones did, promotional trailer about Glover taking him to the limit, notwithstanding. But you need a guy like that, and you need those kind of guys in the middle of this division, especially, or in that upper tier of this division, especially given how many dudes are old and fading, and there are a couple of intriguing guys on the way up.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we always kind of joked about, like, Yushin Okami being that, like, we hate to use the word gatekeeper, so we use, like, because he's a high-level gatekeeper, so we call him, like, the samurai defender of the middleweight crown, you know, like, you need these guys, man. There's guys that you know, kind of guard that coveted top 10, and then there's guys who guard that top 5, and I really think with how everything looks at 205 right now, that's worth a share of that, because I absolutely agree with you. I don't favor him in any of those matchups, and I'm not sure he beats Ryan Bader again, to be honest with you, so, you know, I think but it's going to be interesting to see that he still has the moxie to get after it, you know what I mean? Because I was worried, you know, going in, like, man, you know, he looks so listless against Phil Davis. You know, I was like, man, OSP's going to be the same, and if OSP wins, then Glover goes, you know, kind of loses that sheen for good. OSP's still going to have some exciting fights in there, so yeah, I think it was a good fight for the division, but yeah, it really didn't do anything movement-wise.
Yeah, if you look at a guy like maybe Shogun or Fab Maldonado as sort of the gatekeeper, the bouncer that's letting you into the club, Glover's kind of the guy at the VIP with another checklist, and you got to be on that list for him to let you into that upper echelon.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I couldn't agree more. And you know, he fits that model where, you know, you have an established name fighting some of your up and coming guys. So I think that's the way we're going to see the UFC use him, at least for the next fight or two.
It's the Kibor Kimura podcast on Province Sports Radio. We're going to pause for a minute, come back with Dwayne Finley, talk about some of these fights that are coming up on the horizon, and get into just a little bit of general MMA stuff. We'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. E. Spencer Kite talking with my man Dwayne Finley of Bleacher Report, UFC.com, various places. Tremendous piece up right now, actually, on UFC.com on Dustin Poirier, who has a big fight set. Sort of fits as a perfect segue into some of these fights coming up. Poirier, who has looked very good since moving to lightweight, going to be taking on Joe Duffy in the main event of the UFC's return to Dublin. That story with Dustin is one of those things that a lot of people didn't know. You got a chance to sit down with him when we were in Las Vegas a couple months back. Give people just a little bit of background on the piece and on Dustin himself and what he had to say about this transition to lightweight and your thoughts on his prospects there in a division that we both feel is the deepest, most talented in the UFC.
Well, it was an interesting situation. You know, I kind of handpicked these fighting life subjects, and I, you know, I got to thinking, I'm like, man, you know, I wanted to do something a little more in depth on Dustin for a long time, but, you know, fight bills out there, so it's like, you know, this guy has a documentary pretty much based around him, you know, what's new to tell, and then I just kind of had this feeling that there is just something, there is more there than fight bill told, than anything else, because it's just kind of a different, you know, intensity about him. I don't want to say a chip on his shoulder, but there's just kind of like something there that always kind of fascinated me. So when I sat, you know, we sat down and for all your listeners, yeah, Spencer was there, so he saw the magic happen, so to speak. Just kidding, but yeah, you know, I kind of watched how he was kind of looking at everything when he was walking in that little bistro wherever we were at. And I was kind of looking, I was like, okay, now I'm watching him kind of He's just not, like, put his head down walking through everything. He was kind of just looking and examining everything, and I'm like, all right, well, that's a tendency that tells you a little something about him, you know? And the whole thing, it was like, well, he wasn't doing it because he was, like, paranoid or what's up. He's doing it because he's just kind of taking everything in. Like, he just kind of, you know, he examines everything. So when we got to talking, and he started talking about, you know, the stuff he's been through with, you know, in his life, he said, you know, he's like, he's talking about how he got the fight game, and the fight game has been his education. When most people say that, you know, they're saying, yeah, you know, I learned, you know, how to be tough, and, you know, I learned, you know, how to push myself in the fight game. That's not what Dustin was talking about. Dustin's talking about, you know, the things that he's learned just from being in the business of the fight game, you know, the people he's been around, the rooms he's been able to sit in, the knowledge he's been able to pull in and adapt to, you know, those are the things, the opportunities that he never would have had coming out of where he's from had it been not for fighting, you know. He dropped out his freshman year of high school, never graduated high school, you know, met his girl when they were 18, got married when they were 20, and they've, you know, she's been basically his entire support system ever since, so... you know, you look at those situations, you're like, okay, well, it takes a certain kind of person to not only survive those situations, but to thrive in them. It requires even more. So that was the kind of the, you know, after the talk with Dustin, you know, I sat on it for a little while and thought about it. And yeah, it just kept coming back to, you know, and that's how the piece starts, you know, talking about just kind of watching how he looks at things. And it just kept coming back to that. So, you know, I kind of dove into that and got to, you know, and was able to tie it together. I feel pretty nicely so far. You know, people have, you know, reached out and people seem to have liked the piece. Dustin himself hit me up the day it came out. And, you know, he was like, man, he's like, you know, you did an awesome job. And thanks for telling my story the right way. And you know, and those things, like all the accolades in the world don't mean anything to me. But when the person you're telling a story about, it takes the time to hit you up and is like, hey, you know, you told my story in a direct and honest way, and I appreciate that. Then you know, as a storyteller, that's all the you know, reward I need, so to speak. So yeah, man, it was an interesting story to tell. I'm glad I got the chance to do it. And like I said, not, you know, kind of on an ending note on it. You know, it's a challenge when there's been a documentary done about somebody, and you know, like that's what people know, and you know, to kind of dive into that and see if you can get a little something different out there. You know, that was a challenge that I'm glad I took.
Yeah, it's definitely a piece people should check out. It is on UFC.com right now. Dustin Poirier, Education Through Fire. And Fightville is out there if you haven't seen it. I do believe it's on Netflix. Check that out. A very good documentary. I actually got to see it with Dustin in Toronto the week of UFC 129. Crazy to see how far he has come, both from that documentary and from that week in Toronto 5 years ago now, I guess, to where he's at. One of the things that I really liked about the piece, and he and I had spoken about it a little earlier in his career, is just his talking about Robbie Lawler and how important that is, because I think that's one of those things that people don't necessarily get. I know Robbie Lawler brought him with him to UFC 171 in Dallas when he fought Johnny Hendricks for the first time. And I know from talking to Dustin, that meant a lot to him to get to see and experience not just a big fight of that magnitude, but a big fight of that magnitude around a guy that he looks up to, around a team that has been together, in talking about Robbie and Matt Pena, who has since said, you know, we got our championship. I'm out. We defended it. I'm good. I'm taking off. I'm going out on the high note. I know that had a big impact, and I think that's one of those things that we're going to see more and more of these young fighters coming up that get the opportunity to be around some of these elite athletes, be around some of these weeks. Even Hot Sauce Scott Holtzman talked about his week in Nashville was easier because he had been there and sort of knew what to expect from being there with some of his teammates from the MMA lab. So that to me was a very cool part to sort of round it all out, because I do think Dustin Poirier is a guy that has the chance to make some noise in this division.
Oh, absolutely. And the Robbie Lawler aspect is with 100% something that's crucial to Dustin, because Dustin, you know, he's been on the cusp of bigger things multiple times and had, you know, devastating losses, so to speak, in those big moments. And then, you know, he looks at, you know, Robbie Lawler, and he's like, man, you know, Robbie bounced back from, like, he was tiptoeing the line of obscurity, and then Robbie's a champion now and fighting, the best chapter of his career. So I think those things are going to matter to Dustin. I think those things matter to Dustin because I really don't think his adversity is over. You know what I mean? I think he's a young guy. He's been fighting for a long time. But, you know, Mike Brown told me about Dustin. He said when Dustin came to ATT, it's like people couldn't wait to get on the mats with him because he couldn't stop anybody from doing what they, you know, what they wanted to do to him. You know, and you know, nothing against Tim Crater's gym, but, you know, Dustin was a big fish in a small pond there. And then he goes to ATT. And he's getting his ass kicked up and down that gym. Well, Mike Brown told me, he's like, dude, he goes, now you come down there. He's like, nobody wants to go with him. You know what I mean? He's like, Dustin can handle anybody in that gym. You know, and I know like him and Dustin Will Brooks, Bellator lightweight champ, you know, they go hard all the time. So, you know, I think despite what Joe Duffy's big, it's going to be huge. If Dustin wins, he becomes, I think, even though Duffy's a still considered a prospect, I think this would be a big win for Dustin because I think it puts him on the verge of the upper tier of the division, land him a big fight afterwards. But, you know, if he doesn't win against Duffy, it's a big setback too. But at 26, he still has enough years to get back up there. So I think it's definitely a fighter people need to pay attention to because there's no such thing as a boring Dustin Poirier fight.
Right. Absolutely the case. Every time that dude gets in the cage, it is entertaining. It is fun to watch. A couple more fights that have been announced in the last couple of weeks since you and I have talked on one of these podcasts. We're getting another version, another entry in the Vitor Belfort Dan Henderson saga. Interested, not interested, good way to use two sort of aging veteran dudes on a card in Brazil?
My interest in this fight is less than the rematch. You know what I mean? Like, I enjoy watching both guys fight. I don't enjoy watching both guys fight each other. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. They both could be, you know, used in a different way. You know, I didn't understand it. I didn't understand it, especially when there was so much, you know, people were, you know, calling Vitor out. You know, you need to get say Vitor wins again, what does beating Dan Henderson do for a guy who just fought for the title?
Right.
It doesn't do anything. And that's what I'm saying. And Dan Henderson, yeah, I mean, we know Dan's in that kind of that lane where he's just fighting, you know, big name guys, you know, kind of getting the Rich Franklin treatment. Nah, man, I'll pass on it. You know, I mean, I'm sure when they fight, I'll watch it because I'll be covering it. But, like, as a fan, this was just like, yeah, we've already, you know, been there, done that, you know, so.
I'll skip UFC 193 for a minute because I'm sure you and I will get into that extensively when we get there. A week after that, Monterrey, Mexico, Kelvin Gastelum comes back to welterweight against Matt Brown. Feels like violence guaranteed. I'm excited that the UFC actually made the correct, what I think is the correct decision of letting Kelvin Gastelum go back to welterweight. I know you have some experience in a relationship with Matt Brown. This has got to be fairly high on the excitement scale.
Oh, yeah, man. I couldn't agree more. I'm glad they let Kelvin come back to 170. That's where he belongs. And hopefully he learns that the UFC won't tolerate him not making weight. But, you know, Matt Brown's a different kind of animal, man. I think, you know, Kelvin's chin is proven to be rock solid. But yeah, man, I think this is going to be a scrap. And I think it's going to be, like you said, it's going to be violence on display. Maybe some abrupt sweeps getting handed out. But yeah, man, it's a crucial fight for both guys. And that's what I like the most about it. Kelvin coming back to 170 makes him an interesting threat in that division. And Matt Brown, when the win over Tim Means didn't serve much to him except stop his skid. And, yeah, man, whoever wins this fight is going to be a major player in 2016.
Well, and sort of to tie in that Glover Teixeira being the bouncer, letting people in at the velvet rope to the VIP, Matt Brown kind of feels that way a little bit at welterweight, had those two losses to upper-tier guys, the last two title holders. This is sort of the test for Calvin Gastelum. Obviously, he had the fight with Tyron Woodley. Still almost won it, even though he looked awful and had a miserable weight cut. So this feels like the young kid from Yuma's opportunity to really put himself in that conversation.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that's the thing, is every time we've seen Calvin fight, he's improved. He's growing in all aspects of his game. His submission game is getting better. His striking game is getting better. Plus, he's just tough as nails. So I think that's going to be the appeal here with Matt Brown and Kevin Gastelum. They're just two super tough dudes, and they're not gonna want to take a back step. So yeah, man, I think with Calvin's wrestling, I think Matt Brown will be working hard on that to make sure he doesn't get Johnny Hendricks again. But I don't see Calvin coming out and wrestling him right away, man. I think Calvin's gonna come out wanting to bang with him to show that he can do it in against the best of the best at 170. So I think we're for some cliched as it may be, fireworks.
You mentioned two super tough dudes that don't take a backward step at welterweight. We'll circle back a week before Brown Gastelum, UFC 193. It is official. There were talks that it was maybe coming north of the border, but instead it's going to Australia. Robbie Lawler versus your boy Carlos Condit, the natural born killer. I don't know that there's a fight that I've been more excited for than this one. And that's saying something, because I was pretty pumped for Lawler McDonald and for Conor McGregor Jose Aldo, which evidently ended up getting scrapped. But this is maybe the most intoxicating fight I can think of right now. And I understand some of the, like, why is Carlos Condit getting the fight based on results? But when you look at what he brings to the table, what he did against Thiago Alves, and just sort of the potential of this fight being another instant classic like Lawler had against Rory McDonald, it feels like the right fight to me.
Oh, yeah, it does. And the thing was, is, you know, I wasn't really even thinking about that. And then when we were in Vegas, you know, I started hearing, I talked to a few people, and they said, you know, I think, you know, it sounds like Conor's going to get the title shot. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, like, but it makes sense if you look at it from the UFC's perspective. You know, Woodley didn't look great in his last fight. You know, Hendricks, you know, even though he lopsided Matt Brown, UFC wasn't happy in his performance. And then you have, you know, the fact that Woodley versus, you know, Woodley's been jockeying for this Hendricks fight for a really long time. That fight seemed good to go, you know. And then you have the fact that Condit came back and, you know, and snuffed Thiago Alves in the fashion that he did. And then you just look at the matchup and you're like, man, you know what? You know, do people really want to see a third Lawler Hendricks this close? You know, Woodley Lawler, and then you're like, Condit Lawler? You're like, hell yes. You know, like, that is, like, if you look up, after that fight's over, when you look up Violence in the Dictionary, it's going to have Lawler Condit on there. That's going to be brutal. And both guys are durable. Both guys, they don't come to play, you know what I mean? So I think you're both guys are intense. I think we're going to just see some hands and feet flying with the illest of intentions. And yeah, man, and I'm excited for Carlos to land this. You know, the guy, you know, worked hard to come back from that blown out his knee against Woodley, and he looked like a beast against Alves, like he didn't, you know, miss any time. So yeah, man, it's gonna be an intense situation, and yeah, man, mark that as potential fight of the year.
Yeah, circle that one on your calendars. It's officially November 15th, but that's because it's in Australia, so it takes place on the Sunday there. It will be November 14th here in North America, UFC 193. As more stuff gets announced, we'll definitely have it on Keyboard Kimura. Got to wrap this up because I got some interviews coming up. You got some places to be. Kids went back to school today, if I'm not mistaken, so probably going to have to get them off the bus at some point here soon. I appreciate you doing this, man. Let people know how to stay in touch and how to follow what you've got coming out.
You know, always a pleasure. And yes, you know, the kids will be piling off the bus here in a little bit. Yeah, man, and just something, a little future. You know, we just talked about the Condit situation. I have, if anybody is familiar with the training camp projects that I do, like I did with Mitch Miller or the road trip, I'm doing my next one with Carlos Condit. It starts in October. At the beginning of October, so I'm gonna join him the last like 2.5 weeks of his camp, and I will give you an inside look at everything that's leading up to the MBK's title shot. So yeah, man, just anybody interested, follow me at Dwayne Finley MMA on Twitter. I got stuff coming out this week on UFC.com. Bleach Report will double back here in about 2 weeks to do a podcast. We'll talk about all that stuff. So yeah, man, just follow along. I always got good stories coming out.
He is Dwayne Finley. I am E. Spencer Kite. We thank you for listening to another edition of the Keyboard Kimura podcast here on Province Sports Radio. Hopefully nothing goes wrong with Paul Chapman in the next 7 to 10 days and we can get him back here. Get well soon, Chappie. We'll be back next week to preview UFC Fight Night Holloway versus Oliveira in Saskatoon. Until then, keep listening, keep reading the blog at theprovince.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Keyboard Kimura, the official mixed martial arts podcast of The Province. Read the Keyboard Kimura blog on theprovince.com, follow them on Twitter at Keyboard Kimura, or visit them on Facebook at facebook.com/Keyboard Kimura.